Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 14th, 2007, and this is show number 78. So has anyone noticed that I changed up the naming convention on the blog and the RSS feed? Well, I noticed that I was really appreciating that other podcasts I was listening to were identified not just by the date and episode number, but also some key things that happened in the cast. So it was kind of good to be able to go, wait a minute, did I listen to that one already? Oh, yeah, that one little keyword lets me know I've already listened to it. So I thought, man, why the heck don't I do that for my listeners? Well, now if you look at the episode names in your favorite podcatching client, instead of just saying NC2007-0114, it'll be followed by Waxing, BSD Icon Explained, GIMP Shop. I'm hoping that'll help you guys out as much as the other podcasters help me. Also on the website, I realized that I call each entry NoSillaCast 01-1407 number 77, but then right below that, WordPress automatically enters the date. So what am I putting the date in there for? Not helping at all, but I could have room for more information if I get rid of that. So now the date is gone from the title, and if you can't tell it's NoSillaCast from the banner at the top, you're on the wrong site anyway, so I got rid of that too. So now all you get is the episode number, but then there's room for key things I talked about. Let me know if you like these changes. I'm pretty sure it's going to help people sort through all the slop on their computers and MP3 players to not listen to the same thing twice. I did it on the feed as well. Well, I've finally gotten WordPress widgets working. You'll notice that the sidebar is getting much cleaner. I figured out how to make things go in the right places, which was an adventure in itself. Turns out there's a thing called sidebar widgets, which I installed a while ago into WordPress, but I didn't tame it until yesterday. I worked literally for hours. Okay, hours with my ADD kicking in constantly and Steve asking me to help him fix other computer problems, but it seemed like hours of work. It spanned hours. I searched the WordPress forums to no avail to solve my problem. Well, I finally broke down and created my own account there and posted my question. I noticed they had a cool thing there. You can subscribe to your own post as an RSS feed. That was pretty cool. So I set it up in Firefox, which took just about as much work as hitting a carriage return, and there it was in my bookmarks bar. Well, just for fun, I checked it right away to see how it worked, and one of the moderators of the WordPress website had answered already. I posted at 00:58:51, and they responded at 01:00:25. That's 1 minute and 34 seconds to get a response. And yes, I did that on a calculator, by the way. Amazing, though, that, I mean, a minute and 34 seconds to get a response. It was fantastic. And it turned out to be a good clue, but not the full answer. So I wrote back, and they wrote back, and a full 10 minutes and 4 seconds into the exchange, my problems were all solved. How's that for response time? They never should have answered me so quickly, because you know I won't even try to do anything on my own now. I'll just post right away. Well, that's not true, but the temptation is sure there. Probably won't work quite as long on my own. One cool thing about WordPress is that when you get your answer, you're supposed to change the status to resolved. That's cool because when you're searching for an answer, it's sure nice to be able to filter by resolved. Anyway, I think podfeet.com is coming along great and it's been a lot of fun to learn new stuff. The thing I know you'll all be glad to know is that I was able to get my PayPal donate button working again. So I know you're going to want to rush on over there and throw some money in to help support the podcast. Well, I can continue down my obsession with waxing cars in the past few weeks. My daughter Lindsay whined that I hadn't waxed her car since summer, so I waxed it again. Well, I always take pictures when I'm done, and I started looking back through my photos, and I discovered that I've waxed her car 4 times in 10 months. Come on, that's nuts! I knew I waxed frequently, but I really thought it was no more than 3 times a year. When I called her on it, I pointed out that the last time I waxed her car was only in September, and she said, well, that is summer, right? Oh well, after waxing her car, I went ahead and waxed Kyle's car too. Oh, and then Lindsay's friend Mari suggested that I wax her car too. This one was actually really, really fun. It's a 1997 Camry that her aunt and uncle gave her that only had about 15,000 miles on it when she got it a year ago. Apparently, they just never drove it. Literally, little old lady in Pasadena kind of a story. So the paint job was in fabulous condition, but the finish on the paint was just trashed. LA is tough on cars anyway, with all the gunk that falls out of the air. Makes me worry just a bit about what we're breathing. Not enough to leave and go be cold, but it does make me wonder. So anyway, I put a few pictures in the show notes to show it off. This was the most dramatic change to a car I've ever done. It was so much fun. She had some huge scratches in her hood where her roommate had dragged a box across it, and they totally came out. You can see in the pictures, I got a shot of this big, it's like 6 fingernail scratches down the side, and I got some, and then the next shot shows that it's completely gone. I got some great reflection shots too. Head on over to the show notes to admire my work. Very excited about it. All right, is it time to talk tech already? Heck, I burned up half the show already, I think. Better get cracking. All right, last week I was talking about the specialized searches on Google, and I mentioned 2 things I didn't understand. The first was that the BSD search had an odd-looking devilish guy, and I wondered what the significance was. The second thing I didn't understand was that all of the specialized search URLs were very simple, like google.com/Mac, google.com/BSD, but for some unknown reason, the Microsoft specialized search was google.com/microsoft.html. What's up with that? Well, listener Matt wrote in with the poop behind both of those things. Hey, Allison. Just listened to your latest podcast on the way to work and enjoyed it muchly. Had a couple of comments. Should I actually hit the podcast site and put these into the comments/forum areas? Anyway, in case anyone cares, the BSD daemon you mentioned in the Google specialized searches is named Beastie. There's a lot more trivia in his logo. The trident represents forking of processes. His shoes represent the fast file system, etc. When you mentioned that Microsoft's only Microsoft specialized search area ended in HTML, my guess is that it's a minor jab, because before Microsoft approached the web, HTML files ended in .html, but Microsoft introduced .htm. And over the years, that has been the cause of headaches for countless systems and web people. Just a thought. Sounds like a little jab at Microsoft. Thanks for the podcast. Really enjoyed it. Matt. Well, thanks, Matt, for the kind words and the clarification. I love the idea that people so much thought into little private jokes like what the BSD demon's shoes mean. And of course, I like any private joke making fun of Microsoft. I mean, you know, who doesn't? I think what I enjoyed most about your letter, though, was that instead of referring to the little BSD guy as a demon, you called him a daemon, D-A-E-M-O-N, which is the archaic Greek word meaning demon, but in computing it means a background process that handles requests for services such as print spooling and file transfers, and is dormant when not required. It's clear to me that you're a geek to the core, as though knowing what the shoes on the little BSD dude mean was not enough to clue me in. Anyway, you're my people, that's for sure. Thanks again for the nice note. If you're on a budget, but really want a powerful image editor like Photoshop, don't have that $600-$800 laying around, you should consider using the GIMP. I did a full review of the GIMP on show number 62 back in September of 2006, and I really liked it. It's open source, so the price is right. I happen to use Photoshop Elements myself, and I found features in the GIMP that are only in real Photoshop, like the ability to work in different channels, red, green, and blue. You can't do that in Photoshop Elements, but the free GIMP does it. So the GIMP, one of the great things about the GIMP is it works on Mac OS X, Linux, and Windows. Well, why am I talking about it again after all this time? Well, one of the things that's bothersome about the GIMP is that the menus aren't quite where I expect them to be, as in Photoshop Elements, and people have told me that I need the plugin called GIMP Shop. The first search I hit was to gimpshop.net, but don't write that URL down. When I went searching for the download, it took me to a site that still showed the same URL, but was full of ads, and nowhere could I find the actual download. Showed the words as though it had the download, but there was no link. But plenty of opportunities for me to meet new people on this site. Well, I did further searching for the GIMP shop, and I found the download on of all places, Wikipedia. Never would have thought they had that kind of thing, but maybe the people who did this post knew about the scammers out there trying to mislead innocents like me. The Wikipedia link is at en.wikipedia.org/wiki/gimpshop. Now note that GIMP is all caps. Or just go to the link in the show notes, that might be easier. Well, GIMP Shop was written by Scott Moschella from plasticbugs.com if you want to go straight to the actual source. According to Wikipedia, GIMP Shop is a modification of the free open-source graphics program, GNU Image Manipulation Program, otherwise known as GIMP, intended to replicate the feel of Adobe Photoshop. Its primary purpose is to make users of Photoshop feel comfortable using GIMP. Sounds perfect for me. Well, before I get too far into this, I need to explain that under Mac OS X, the GIMP runs under X11, which is not something I fully understand, but you need to have X11 loaded from the developer's tools before you can run the GIMP. I don't think that's true in the other operating systems like in Linux and Windows, but I'm not sure. Maybe you do need it in Linux. I'm not sure. But I know on the Mac you need X11. In any case, go back and check out show number 62 if you need the full explanation of how to do that. GIMP Shop is a big download, more than 80 megabytes. But if it's Photoshop on a budget, that's really not that bad. When you first download it, don't be fooled by the icons in the disk image. One of them is called Drop Menu RC on Me. And there's another icon called Menu RC. Well, I dropped Menu RC on the file called Drop Menu RC on Me, and I got an error. What the heck? I had to resort to reading the dreaded README, which was nice and easy to follow, but they explain in there that you install GIMP Shop just like any other application by dragging it from the disk image to your applications folder. That tricky little thing about Menu RC has to do with a way to get the shortcut menus to exist like in Photoshop. At first I thought I'd leave it to the end, but then I discovered that without it, there really wasn't any discernible difference between the GIMP and GIMP Shop. I put screenshots of the two applications side by side on the website so that you could see the lack of differences. I mean, there's a little thing here and there. But I'm not really sure what the big fuss is about. Well, after I followed the actual instructions, which tell you to, you do that drop menu on Menu RC, that whole thing, you do that after you launch it once, and then it works. So I was able to get the menu changes to take place, and it seemed to work fine. Odd thing I should warn you about, if for the Mac users in the crowd, you have to use Control instead of Command in the Apple version. So, like, you use Control S instead of Command S like we're used to on the Mac. I'm getting used to always messing that up nowadays anyway. Since I'm in Windows so often, I basically do it backwards wherever I am. I really get confused on cut and paste between operating systems. I'll do a Control C from Windows and then Command V in OS X, or at least that's what I meant to do. And I'll always get it backwards. Well, one really annoying thing about the GIMP that just bugged the crud out of me last time I tried to use it is that when you click on a tool, it actually just selects the window the tool is sitting in, so you have to click again to get the tool to be activated. I get the feeling it's X11's fault, not GIMP Shop, because the developer solves that for the GIMP Shop because he includes an included Apple script that changes X11's behavior. The script is called Turn on X11 Focus Follows Mouse. And you run that with X11 open, quit, and then reopen it. And from then on, just hovering over a palette makes it active. That's a very welcome change. Before this, I'd always click and then try to use the tool and get really frustrated when it wasn't working and I'd look over and the tool wasn't selected. So now it works like you would normally expect. As I explained earlier, I found GIMP Shop actually through Wikipedia there too, and I found a little mistake in the documentation there. They had the installers for OS X, Windows, Linux, and Solaris, but in the text above it explaining the tools, they said, it was originally developed for Mac OS X, and later on it said GIMP Shop has also been ported to Windows and Linux. They forgot all about Solaris. Now here's what's cool. Instead of writing to the developer or to a webmaster to get their page fixed, or leaving it misleading for the next guy, since it was in Wikipedia, I simply clicked edit and fixed it. Feels good to be able to help. I sure hope it was the first comment that was right, not the second one. Sure hope it works on Solaris. Oh well, somebody else can fix it. And now it's time for the HDA Bob commercial. As I explained last week, HDA Bob is my mechanic of 28 years. Maybe it's 29 now. It was 1978, so it might even be 29 years. He's a real geek at heart, so he's made a great website to educate and entertain. It's hosted at hdabob.com. Today, I'd like to encourage you to click on the link to Interesting Travel Stories. Or you can go to the show notes, and I have a link to take you directly there. Bob has collected some funny, entertaining, and heartwarming stories from his years of fixing Hondas in Southern California. Head on over to hdabob.com and read about a driver who got locked in her car, how the Bureau of Consumer Affairs could not believe no complaints had ever been lodged against him, or read about his grandmother's legacy. I hope you find these stories as endearing as I do. Last week, I did a pretty comprehensive first look at the new VMware Fusion Beta for the Mac. It's a competitor of Parallels, if you missed last week's show. And it allows you to run other operating systems on top of OS X. I did some more extensive messing around with it this week, and I found some wonderful stuff and some bad. I have to explain something about Parallels before I can explain what's so good about Fusion. Parallels comes with Parallels tools, which are drivers that make most things work okay. Without the drivers, the mouse is all hinky and the graphics are weird, but with the drivers, things look pretty normal. Parallels supports USB 1.1 devices, but slows down USB 2.0 devices to 1.1 speed. Doesn't seem like that big of a deal. I mean, I'm not in that big of a hurry to download things from my pen drive, for instance. But where it does make a big difference is that you can't use any kind of webcam these days without USB 2.0, and that includes the built-in EyeSight camera. I searched the forums at Parallels, and nobody can get any USB webcams working, no matter what they try. Okay, so now that we're on the same page with what Parallels can't do, let's talk again about Fusion Beta. Turns out, Fusion also has VMware tools, just like Parallels tools, but in addition to that, it will allow you to load the Bootcamp drivers. Bootcamp drivers are available as a download from Apple, so they're free to use any way you see fit. Once Fusion Beta has been loaded, Windows XP installed, and the VMware tools loaded, all you have to do is throw in the Bootcamp driver CD, and the auto run will do the rest. XP will whine and complain that the drivers aren't certified, but just keep saying okay. After installing the Bootcamp drivers and restarting XP, you'll now be able to use the EyeSight with Windows, which is pretty cool. I also installed a Logitech QuickCam without the Bootcamp drivers, and it was a no-go, but after loading the Bootcamp drivers, it worked like a charm. The main thing I think that gives us is access to USB 2.0 devices at full speed, which, as I said, Parallels does not give us. I tried loading the Bootcamp drivers on Vista under Fusion Beta, but it did not work. It was worth a try, though, I figured. After I did all of this, I was pretty excited, but Fusion Beta has some real issues. It takes forever to launch. I'm talking like 7-10 minutes, where Parallels is like under 2 minutes. And I've had it lock up my system, that's Fusion Beta, it's locked up my system more than once. Might be my impatience level, but when shutting down, the entire Mac is unusable for quite some time, like at least 10 minutes. Where with Parallels, I can continue to work with slightly degraded performance, and at that, only for 2 or 3 minutes. I'm going to continue to play with it to see if I can tune the performance to improve the user experience, and I'll keep you posted, of course. I'm also going to try again, seeing if I can get the Bootcamp drivers to load in Parallels. I think I tried that before, but maybe I wasn't really paying attention, didn't do it right, because I don't see why it wouldn't work. Seems to me it should work. Maybe there's some basic reason it can't, though. And I also remember reading something that I didn't pay too much attention to, that something like Parallels could give you access to your Bootcamp partition, which I don't actually have, but maybe there's a way I can weasel in there and figure out a way to get the Bootcamp drivers to work. Anyway, I'll keep you posted on that. It's time to pick up where we left off on listener Ryan's list of his favorite applications. He sent me a ton of them, and there's been, I think we got one I didn't like too much, and all the rest of them have been fantastic. If you take a lot of digital photos like I do, part of the fun is sharing them with people. I tend towards email, but my kids use MySpace and Facebook to share photos. The problem we have to solve here is our digital cameras take such high-resolution photos these days, and we either waste a bunch of bandwidth sending huge pictures, which most sites dumb down anyway, or we irritate the daylights out of our friends and family sending these gargantuan photos that clog up their email. Wouldn't it be great to have an easy-to-use application that resizes images en masse and works with any format? That's what Ryan says small image from iconus.ch/fabian/smallimage2 can do. Go click on the link in the show notes. That's too much to remember. Well, he says also says it will even strip out the EXIF data from photos to decrease the file sizes. Sounds like we should give it a try, doesn't it? I downloaded and installed Small Image and noticed right away that it has the most important feature. That's a really cool logo. It's a red vise with a silver bar through it. Like, you know what I mean, the kind that you used to hold wood in the shop when you're sawing on it. Very slick looking. I put a screen snapshot in the show notes because I knew you'd want to head over and see that right away. Well, of course, I skipped any kind of readme, but I did take a look around the website. Small Image is freeware, but they have helpfully include a donate button, which I really like. Small Image looks like it has a lot of stuff going on in it, so let's dive right in. It opens with a large blank area in the middle where you can see the file names you're working on. At the top, there are 7 buttons. Starting from the left, you can add a file, remove one file, or remove all the files. There's a preference button that allows you to control the behavior of Small Image, things like whether to empty the file list after a successful process or not, whether to show the image preview, and finally to allow you to drop JPEGs on the application icon to process them. I went ahead and added a file by dragging it into the big open window, and I noticed on the right sidebar drawer that Small Image tells you all kinds of information about your photo, including all the camera information like exposure, resolution, focal length, and also things like the dimension and resolution of the photo. I don't need this information, but it's interesting to look at, and I suppose if you're a real photographer, this would be useful. The right sidebar drawer is pulled in and out using the Infos button on the top menu bar. This site is hosted in China, and the author is French, but saying Infos instead of Info is one of the very few cases of grammar missteps that I've found, which is truly amazing considering the language difficulties. In the menu bar, there's also a Customize button at the top that lets you add and delete things from the menu in standard Apple form. Finally, there's the main button that says Process Files. This is the real meat of the application, and to see what it's going to do, there's a whole panel of options down at the bottom. First, there's a whole slew of checkboxes for profiles you can remove, and I don't really know much about these profiles, but it seems to want to remove them, so I let it do it. Evidently, these profiles are normally stored in a photo and must take up space in the file size. You can remove ICC, EXIF, IPTC, the comments field, and others. I'm pretty sure that EXIF data is the stuff I was talking about that you could see, like, the exposure setting and all that kind of stuff. Well, next you can choose to remove, add, or keep the icon that shows in the Finder when you look at a file. You can also change the compression quality if you like. There's a slider so you can set the level of compression, which is defaulted to 75%, which is about what I usually use, so that's good. Down below, you can set the scaling, and that is what will be helpful in emailing and uploading pictures to the web. Before I go to the options in there, it's critical that you pay attention to the section to the right, which is where you define how the files will be saved. The default is to put the pictures right where the originals are, but luckily, the default is also to add a suffix of -small. So if it was called dog.jpg, now it would be dog-small.jpg. So the default is certainly safe, and that's good. I would hate to recommend this application to you and have you overwrite your wedding pictures or the birth of your first child with little thumbnails, so please pay attention to that section. So back in the scaling section, you can choose No scaling, which I guess all you're going to achieve is stripping off the EXIF data and all that. You can also choose fixed or relative scaling. I started with relative, and I assumed that the scaling would be a percentage, so I typed in 25, expecting the photo to shrink to 25% of its original size. I clicked Process Files, and in just a second or two, I had two files, the original and one with dash small after the name. I opened both in Photoshop Elements. The original was approximately 36 by 27 inches at 72 dpi, and the smaller version was approximately 9 by 6.7. I launched my handy HP 12C RPN calculator emulator on my Mac and checked the math, and it was exactly correct. So far, so good. Time to try the fixed option. It shows width and then an empty field to the right. Next to the word width, there's an up-down arrow, and if you click it, a whole slew of options pop up, allowing you to instead set the height, smallest, largest, and max width or height. I'm not sure what smallest and largest means in this context, or even max width or height if you're picking a fixed size. Maybe the idea is with the max options that if you say you might have a picture in the list that's actually smaller than the fixed dimension, and you don't want it upsampled to that size and therefore lose quality. I wasn't sure if the width field was asking for physical dimensions or pixels, but I hoped it was pixels, so I typed in 300. Instantly this time, it converted the file, and when I opened it up, it was 300 pixels wide. Good to know. So far, it's all working very, very intuitively. As if all of this weren't enough for a freeware program, it also allows you to store presets. So get all the options exactly the way you like it, and in the bottom right, there's a pull-down where you can choose presets. Once you've saved one to get to the one you want in the future, you just use that pull-down to show all your stored presets. Elegant and simple. This tool is awesome. My only regret with Small Image is that I didn't check this tool out way back when Ryan sent it to me. This is going to be great for the images I put up on podfeet.com. I frequently take screen snapshots, then I open them in Photoshop Elements, which take forever to open. I hit Image, Resize, change the pull-down from inches to pixels, type in the size I want, hit OK, hit Save, hit OK again for the compression. How much easier if I could just whip open Small Image and keep the defaults at 300 width and throw in all the images at once. That would be awesome. I did test it with some images I put in the show notes after I wrote this, and I wasn't real happy with the compression, so I chose to not compress it at all. I slid it up to 100%, and it looked a lot better. Maybe my screen snapshots are sharp enough as it is, or I should say compressed enough as it is. Well, definitely going to start using Small Image. If it's as useful as it seems at first look, I'll definitely be donating to them too. They have a couple other products on their site, so I'll be checking them out for future podcasts to see if they solve real problems like this one did. Thanks again, Ryan, for one of the most useful and intuitive programs you've sent along. It's time for part 7 in our review of all Google products. We're getting there, guys, but I just keep opening certain things up and there's more and more in there. So I don't know when it's going to end, but not anytime soon. Today we'll start with Google Videos and then move right along. I have no love for Google Video because it irritates the daylights out of me. Thank goodness they bought YouTube so they can get rid of this abomination. Gee, Allison, tell us what you really think. Well, I dislike Google Video for a couple of reasons. My first complaint is that they do not tell you up front all the time if a video is free to watch or you have to pay for it. I was all excited the first time I checked it out to find an episode of a really old TV show. I can't remember what it was. Seems to me it was like Leave It to Beaver or something like that. And I started watching, and after about 30 seconds, it comes up with this big thing saying I have to give them money. Well, I don't really care if they have paid content up there, but they should mark it so you know up front. Perhaps they've changed this since I checked it out last, but I'm too lazy to go check. They made me mad. Secondly, they use this mutant format that means you have to download a client to watch it, which is really lame and confuses a lot of people. I was confused at first, and so have other friends of mine, because it's not even obvious where the real file is when you download it. Third, when I went out there to try and buy videos of Leo Laporte's Call for Help TV show in Canada, I could not find them. Come on, how could their search be bad? If I type in Leo Laporte, It finds all kinds of old footage from the screensavers and other interviews. I just tried it again for the first time in a long time, and this time putting in Call for Help did find the shows in some sort of random order interspliced with all these other shows. For example, the first hit in the list is a show from about 5 years ago when Chris Perillo was hosting it in the United States. It wasn't even Leo at the time. And Chris Perillo loses his mind doing a 24-hour marathon show, just laughs for about 8 straight minutes. It's a pretty funny episode, but definitely not what I'm looking for. You'd think if I was looking for paid content, this wouldn't be that hard, right? I tried sorting by date in that list instead of relevance, and the entire first page is not Call for Help. Okay, so I put in Call for Help followed by Leo Laporte in quotes, and I found all sorts of stuff, including the first hit being Kat Schwartz back in September of 06 being interviewed on Geek Love. All I can figure is she must have talked about her time working with Leo on Call for Help. I tried everything I could think of, and I couldn't find any good way to find the latest episodes to buy. Overall, I think Google Video has too many problems to be recommended, but if you insist on checking it out for yourself, go against my better advice to video.google.com and see how you like it yourself. Next up is the huge category of Google Labs. I think this one's actually going to go into the next show by the time we get done with Google Labs, because it's not a single product, but actually a collection of interesting products. So get comfy, this section's going to take a while. Google Code Search allows you to search public source code for regular expressions, exact strings, and filter your searches to only search in files, directory, or packages matching regular expressions. You can search by languages or by specific licensing terms. Since I'm not a programmer, I wouldn't personally use it, but it sounds kind of cool if you're talented in that area. Google Reader has a tool called, Google Reader, which at first blush appears to be an RSS reader slash aggregator. Well, those are about a dime a dozen, and I didn't think I'd probably enjoy it, but I decided to check it out because, you know, it's all about you, the listener. I ran through the tour, and I even listened to an engineer from Google talk about it, but it still only sounded like an RSS reader. I went ahead and tried adding a subscription, which sounds kind of like pointing to a feed to me, and there was a search field there. I typed in NoSillaCast, and up came my last dozen or so posts from podfeet.com. Right away, I could see fun stuff different from a normal RSS reader. There's a nice flash-based audio player that I can click to listen to the podcast right there. At the bottom of each post, you can add a star. I don't know why, but you can add a star if you want to. You can also click share, which I did, and all I could see was that I got an RSS-ish looking icon next to the word. Well, you can email the post to someone, which sounded cool, but it was kind of badly done. It brought up Gmail. Oh, I should explain, you have to log into this with your Gmail account. So up opens Gmail after I hit share, and in the body it said, and I quote, "This item was sent to you by nosillacast@gmail.com from Google Reader," but that was the beginning of a huge paragraph that had all of my feed posts in it, the short version at least, and at the end of the same paragraph, no carriage returns or anything, it said, "Source, http://www.podfeet.com/wordpress/?p=154. If you no longer wish to receive messages like this, please contact the sender. Try Google Reader today, http://www.google.com/reader. Whew! All blended together in this clunky, huge paragraph. I mean, come on, if I got that, I'd just have hit the spam button right away, assuming it wasn't even from anybody I knew. Very poorly done. A few simple carriage returns in there would have made the content stand out and the marketing of their own site stand out. All right, well, I won't be emailing from here without some editing, that's for sure. I forgot to mention one lame thing. When I got the list of a dozen or so hits of my posts, for some reason it decided to name this subscription New Blog Theme Redux, which was the name of one of my posts a couple of weeks ago, but it wasn't even the name of the most recent episode. I'm not sure why it did that, but luckily there was a feed settings button that allowed me to rename the feed. Since I was poking around anyway, I also found a setting where you can view your starred items. Oh, that's what the starred items are for. You can look at them later in a pile together. I guess that's how you create a greatest hits list or something. Maybe for stuff you want to come back to. You can also organize your feeds into folders, which is kind of nice too. Oh gee, this poking around was a good idea. I also found shared items. Remember I clicked share earlier and I didn't know what it did? It just turned the word share on? Well, it turns out shared items are publicly available at a really long URL they'll give you. And that sounded kind of lame. But then they said that you could put a clip on your site of the shared items. That sounded neato. So I loaded up a few feeds like Bart and David Pogue's blog, found an interesting entry in each one, and I clicked share on both of them. I asked for the code for the clip to put on my site, created a text widget in my new and improved WordPress theme, stuffed that code in there, and bam, I have share items now on my site. This is kind of slick. Well, I originally shared a couple of lame items just testing it, and when I unshared them and shared the good ones, it automatically updated my website. The one thing I didn't like was the color scheme, so I took a look at the code and I found the word green in there. There's not a lot of code, but the word green was in the middle of this glop of programming stuff. Well, I messed around changing the color name to see what would happen. This is kind of my programming style, by the way. Well, it turns out the color defines the whole theme of this little block that goes on your website. Like, I changed the color to black, thinking it would just change the text from green to black, but it changed the background to black and made the text red. It's kind of pretty, but it didn't really fit in. I finally settled on blue, and I think it looks pretty good. So go check it out in the sidebar. I'll probably only keep it up there if I find I really like using Google Reader, but go on over yourself and check it out at google.com/reader. The next thing up in Google Labs is accessible search. I may have talked about it a long time ago because it sounds familiar to me, but bear with me if you've already heard about it. This is where Google provides web search for the visually impaired. So I thought I'd ask my friend Daryl Shandro of the Blind Access Journal podcast, hosted over at blindaccessjournal.com, and see what he thought of it. I'm going to refer to this as my exhaustive research on the topic. Here's Daryl's response when I asked him if Google's accessible search was any good. He says, "Yeah, it is okay. It's a simple UI, and the results are rates-based on their presumed accessibility. But honestly, I don't use it very often, as I don't have any trouble with regular Google." Well, there you have it from an expert in the field. If you'd like to check it out, it's available at labs.google.com/accessible. And definitely check out Daryl's blog and podcast. I think that's enough for this week, so let's sign off for now. Please keep all the great tips and tricks coming by emailing me at allison@podfeed.com or send me an audio comment. I love those. At nosillacast@gmail.com. And of course, head on over to the forums at podfeed.com/forums. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.